Pubcast.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
Because when I had that sense, this is all illusion. And that means also, you know, the various people, so to speak, there was a sense almost of panic, like, oh my gosh, I'm all alone. But fortunately, that flipped, Gina, within seconds to the opposite. I've connected everyone and everything.
Welcome to the Liberated Healer Podcast, where we touch on a variety of topics in the world of spirituality, energetic healing, and everything in between and beyond. Take an adventure on a shooting star with your host, Gina, offering their wisdom, guidance, and everlasting love and support.
Hi, everybody. Gina Cavalier, the host of the Liberated Healer Podcast. Today, we have Howard Eisenberg on. He's an MD, and among other things, and he wrote an amazing book, Dream It, To Do It, The Science and the Magic. And we're going to be going through a lot of the information on here, Decoding Reality 2.0. Welcome, Howard.
Thank you. Hi, Gina. Thank you so much for this opportunity. Thank you.
Yeah. Can you give us a little bit of context of your background, how you got to this book?
Yes and no. I don't know if it'd be a little, but
okay.
You can rein me in and feel free to. I can go pretty, you know, wide.
Yeah.
I've had an interest since childhood in understanding, as strange as this may sound, how things work, how reality works. I became interested in science fiction at an early age, and I was seeing, you know, speculations about things that didn't exist. And years later, they did exist, like Sputniks, you know, spacewalks and so on. And I was reading about it when none of that existed, just other people's imagination. And it just, you know, got me more interested in the realm of the imagination. And the other thing that was, you know, driving my interest was I started I guess in my adolescent, perhaps early teens, occasionally having experiences that some people would call psychic that aren't explained in our conventional understanding of reality. So it just piqued my interest a little more about, you know, what is this? Is there some serious research? And I eventually found there was, such as by one of the pioneers, J.B. Rhine in North Carolina, who I eventually went down and met. So, you know, I say it started with curiosity, and it started also because of some personal experiences that made me think that there's something a little more to reality than we're being taught officially. And yet, even though I went on to do my research at McGill University, I did a joint degree in medicine and psychology, and my thesis for my psychology degree was on telepathy. And I purposely did it there because at the time, the McGill University Department of Psychology was one of the most highly reputed ones in the entire world, probably in the top six at least. And also the chairperson at that time had been a former president of the American Psychological Association, even though he's at McGill in Montreal, Canada. And he had said in print years ago that he rejects all of the evidence of parapsychological experiments on psychic phenomena because he considers it a priori impossible. And I was theoretically impossible, even though he went on to say, the evidence is often more convincing than in more conventional areas of psychology, but he thinks it's impossible. So I decided I'm going to do my research there. I you know, break the paradigm, open it up.
Yeah.
And it was very successful research. And he subsequently changed his mind, and in print as well, and recanted.
Oh,
and said
God.
He's now willing to admit, you know, the evidence for the existence of things like telepathy. So that was still like me, the academic,
you know?
And then I went on with my medical practice, which is a psychotherapy practice for many years. I became involved with a few of the universities and colleges instructing various types of courses. I also developed a corporate consulting practice internationally. It took me all the way to East Asia, as a matter of fact, on dealing with change, dealing with opportunity. So combination, I would say back then, of stress management and creative thinking, creative problem solving.
And
again, that was still me, the academic and professional. And then much more recently, just a few years ago, I was invited by an old acquaintance to do a keynote address for the annual conference of an association of healers, the therapeutic touch practitioners. And to do honor to that invitation, I did a deep dive back into the past psychological literature, into modern physics, into comparative religion, the new research on neuroplasticity of how our thoughts can change the brain, the old wisdom teachings from indigenous cultures, some of the things coming out since there was an opening up about psychedelic experiences, putting it all together so I could do a comprehensive presentation, and then something unexpected happened. All of a sudden, without any warning, I suddenly had a realization, a revelation, if you like, an insight, which was not welcome at the time, to be honest with you. And it was that, contrary to what we've been taught and believe in Western science, and what I had for all of these years, for several decades, that ultimately reality is material, that there is a reality to the so-called external world. We may not understand it yet, but it is real. And somehow it is the cause of us, you know, like we're the product of evolution, so to speak, right, of the chemicals and so on over the eons. And that there's no real ultimate purpose to our lives or the universe. It's just things just happen. Things, you know, randomly collide, sometimes patterns form and so on. And that was conventional thing. It still is, I think, unfortunately. So in that realization, I suddenly realized, Gina, that was illusion. The only reality, not another reality, the only reality is consciousness internally. And just like when we have a dream, at times in the middle of a dream, we don't know we're dreaming. I mean, it's so realistic until we awaken, or we're awakened maybe by someone else who says us maybe we're disturbed in some way, especially with, you know, young children with their mothers sometimes. So again, even though it perceptually and emotionally feels real, and realer, if you like, than just our inner subjective consciousness, it's not. It is illusion. And as I went deeper into the science subsequently, I saw, like, more and more how all the evidence and science, strangely enough, instead of being, how should I say, antithetical to this notion of subjective consciousness being primary, supported it, particularly again in the most modern area of science, which is quantum mechanics and physics.
Well, why do you believe that we didn't come in with more of this knowledge or understanding already as a part of our intelligence that that we had to somehow?
Good question. But if I could also just expand on why I said there's an unwelcome revelation, because when I had that sense, this is all illusion, and that means also, you know, the various people, so to speak. There was a sense almost of panic, like, oh my gosh, I'm all alone. But fortunately, that flipped, Gina, within seconds to the opposite. I've connected everyone and everything. So, you know, subsequently, it was a very beneficial experience. And it's just, you know, it's continued on. Coming back to the other question you raised, which is, so why have humans become confused or forgotten our source? And I call it, you know, the source from which we come. I think that's actually a book I'm working on right now, on the ego. I think our problem is our egos as humans. The ego gives us a sense of separation from each other and nature. The ego is both protective from fear, but it also is acquisitive. It wants more. Whether it's, you know, achieving more than other people, whether it's earning more than other people, whether it's dominating a bigger country or other countries, it's almost like a cancer in consciousness. It keeps wanting more and more, but not for good ends. And we're confused often by emotion, because sometimes we do get a very strong feeling, either, you know, to stay away from something out of fear or desire, or anger sometimes as well. And it's very easy to think, well, that's reality. I mean, whatever, you know, you're feeling is reality, or what you should do or not do or can't do. I try to teach I still work as a practicing physician, psychotherapist, as well as a coach. And I try to teach both my patients and my clients to, as I put it, think through your feelings. So feelings are something that comes up in the screen of your consciousness. as thoughts, as sensations, and so on. But it's for you to consider, not to be controlled by.
Yep, absolutely.
So, but I think for most people, back to your question, they're still very much in the ego sense of separation, both for protective and competitive reasons. And they're still overly affected by emotions. I think it's called emotional reasoning. It's not the same thing as logical reasoning or like reality testing. And I think right now, because so many people have become so involved in various ways on the internet, particularly social media, but also for news these days, that they're not living even in a we call consensual reality. It's so detached. For example, as you know, in your own country, in the United States right now, you have the same objective, how should I say, if you allow me to put it this way, facts of various things. And yet, even among right now, very otherwise you might think educated, intelligent, learned people who previously also had very, how should I say, respectable records of in government of representing their constituents, the communities. But right now, as you know, you have a severe polarization, almost half and half, literally disputing the reality.
I know.
So we can laugh. And I don't want to. And I don't want to. And I don't want to go dark. And I don't want to go dark with this.
Yeah,
it's true.
Your
country may not even exist within less than a year.
I know.
And why? Ego, emotion.
The need to be right. The righteousness has happened on both. Like there, the need to be right because you've gotten. It's been very
need to be right. The need to dominate, and the need, sadly, as you know, as you're hearing in the talk, to eliminate.
Yes.
By killing.
Yes. Yeah.
Right now, there are two world wars going on, as you know, too.
Yeah.
Right? In Europe, the Middle East. Either it could, you know, inflame beyond, like, to even a nuclear level. It's crazy times. But all of this, as I understand it, and I mean that, it's all about ego and emotion.
Yep.
It doesn't have to be this way. And that's why I wrote my book as a wake-up call. Let's wake up. Come out of the dream. Focus on what is more meaningful, what serves us and all those around us, because we all are connected ultimately.
Yeah. And we're all like a glass of water of whatever we put into it, right? So if you're consuming a lot, and you are watching these like a horrible thought in one way or another, and you're ingesting all this, what happens is you're carrying that around now. And what you're doing is you're looking for ways to just to let the top up a little bit. So what happens is just that's why, like, say, for example, you're driving and someone cuts you off and then you go crazy in a way that you might not normally do.
Because
you need to get your glass is full of rage.
Yeah.
Your glass is full of hate.
Yeah.
And you got to get rid of it, and you'll give it to your children. You'll give it to your parents. You'll give it to your friends. You'll give it to your colleagues, because you have to let it go somewhere.
Yeah.
So that's what I've experienced, because I've had people dump rageful things on me in a drop of a hat, and I could just, and it was like all at one time, and I could feel it. It was like, oh my gosh, you had to let that out on someone. Luckily, I'm a more practiced person, because I do have to really practice. I could see it coming, why it was happening. And that's the thing that we really need. That's the thought that you're talking about. The control of the thoughts. We have to consider everything that we're ingesting and redirect it. And you're hurting yourself when you do that, but you're also hurting everything around you.
That's right.
Because people can feel it. You walk into a room, and even if you have babies, children, dogs. I had an old roommate who had mental issues really badly. And that poor dog was just this sweet angel. It looked like a little lassie. And just super full of life. By the time that dog, like 5 years into being with this person, hid all the time, it was scared all the time, because it was living in the environment of that person who had a lot of, you know, outbursts and mental issues. So it spills out to everywhere. So being conscious and realizing that you one conversation, one soul, really have a lot of power. Each one of us have a lot of power.
if we're aware enough.
Yes.
And I'm going to say also disciplined enough. It takes it, for example, the idea of thinking through feelings to make a wiser decision. Again, intellectually, it makes sense. But it doesn't mean it's easy always to do. When we're emotionally aroused, it's very competing for our attention.
There's a happy dog, by the way.
I see.
You know, you know, yeah. Love the
I can tell you a funny story about that, too. I have a recording I made many years ago on my website, a guided meditation recording called The Tranquility Experience.
Yeah.
And a number of my patients spontaneously told me when they would listen to it, they used to listen through speakers as opposed to, you know, earpods or things of that nature. So they often said if they had dogs, they would notice the dog was also responding to it. They'd become like spread eagled on their back, like really, really relaxed. So dogs really respond, you know, again to us in so many levels. Our tonality, our moods, they sense it.
Yeah. Also, let's go back to, I had a note about kind of as we're children, right? And we have a little bit of our ego, right? What do you say about the consciousness of a child and how we're ingesting the world around them?
Well, in a couple of respects, in a sense, when we raise children, and I don't mean this in a heartless way, but in a way, you know, in both the role modeling by the parental figures who may be taking care of them in various ways, depending on the situation of the family, and their school in terms of the teachers they're exposed to, and in part their peer groups, for good or bad. All of this kind of programs them, just like we talk about programming computers, you know, to see things and perceive things and do things in a certain way. And a lot of that is, how should I say, unconscious. Like we're not aware how we're programmed by, let's say, the role modeling with our parents or the competitive peer pressures when we were younger in primary and secondary school. But those things really do affect us. When you become more aware that the way you see and respond to things is not the only way. Mm-hmm. When you become more self-reflective, it frees you to go beyond, you know, who and how you were. And I, again, with the people I work with as clients, you know, I keep emphasizing, you do not have to be who or how you were. And I firmly believe that. But most people don't know that.
Oh, that's really interesting.
The other thing about children is, you know, we have the biblical teaching that he must be as a child again to enter the kingdom of heaven. We also have in Zen, you know, Zen beginner's mind, Zen mind. Yeah. So, and that applies like to a later stage of life, but going, meaning like if you could change your consciousness back to the preconditioned state, you're in more of a state of awareness of what's the full reality. Let me put it that way.
I have this theory. I'm very curious what you think. Cause you know, I do energy work and I believe that our spiritual self and our physical self want to actually mirror each other. So for example, when I was going through a darker time, I was a little bit heavier. My energy just didn't reflect who and what I really wanted to be in the inside. Mm-hmm. But when I would close my eyes and think of my own spirit or my own soul, I would have this vision of myself, you know, and it was really more of a free, more of a, mm-hmm. you know, I had a certain way I looked and carried myself. Right. And so when I was doing my healing, mm-hmm. I would actually try to, I started getting that vision of myself. I try to get back to there. So mm-hmm. for me, it was losing weight, and it was not about the vanity part of it. Other, you know, of mm-hmm. course, some of that helps to feel mm-hmm. better walking in my skin. Mm-hmm. But so it's like as above, so below mm-hmm. kind of thing.
Yeah.
What do you feel about that? Is that a consciousness thing as well?
Or? Well, it could be. Again, as I say, most people don't have that awareness that there's so much more to potential reality than they're aware of. They don't even know theoretically that it could be like that, which is out of touch with it. So the awareness part, you know, is fundamental. And because of the conditioning we all go through, it's not something in this culture, at least in the Western culture, which is very materialistic compared to other cultures. It's not something that's easy for people to spontaneously come to that realization unless they're fortunate to come across the teachings or the influence of other people who expand their awareness.
Because it feels really good. Like, I feel like I've finally gotten to that point where I'm merged, like, between the two.
There's a tool, so to speak, conceptual tool, that I teach my patients and clients, and I call it the inner GPS. So just like there's a GPS for car navigation that helps you know the best route and traffic conditions and so on for what your needs are in terms of your goal, the inner GPS is something as humans we all have. It's factory installed. However, it's not turned on. And the way to turn it on is to take a pause, go into what I call a little bit of, you know, space, spaciousness of consciousness. I'm talking very subtly and very easily. And just reflect on what you're aware of and think through your feelings and then decide to do or not do something in such a way that does you proud of yourself. It's not an ego thing. It's more like, so you don't regret it. So you're not embarrassed. Mm-hmm. And your focus is on, again, your guidance by the inner GPS, not outside people. Because too many people get into things like we commonly call people pleasing, you know, or compliance. Because of fear.
Yeah.
And they're not generally really as liked and respected as people who have self-confidence and just have a generous heart and help out. Mm-hmm. So people may value that they're around, they help out with things, but they don't necessarily like and respect them as much. Why? Because if you don't like and respect yourself, the energy you're giving out is not going to draw it from others.
I think you're talking about what I used to be. Absolutely. I was such a people pleaser. I was so afraid to lose, get abandoned or get people upset at me. I just thought I could smooth out the entire world and I put it all on my shoulders. And, you know, I didn't realize I wasn't respecting myself and I didn't realize they weren't respecting me and they were actually able to really take me for everything I had. And it was energy, money, because I was like, I'm going to be the best friend. I'm going to be the best girlfriend, anything. And, you know, constantly there. And then when I started to fall in love with myself and starting to find my life purpose, and I started to shift away from that, they didn't like it because they're like, where's that old Gina that we could do whatever we want to? I was like, oh, she's gone. She's really gone. Yeah. And I had to lose a lot of people in love, you know, and wishing them well on their journey, but they didn't want to recognize the new version. And that was painful. And a lot of people I talk to are afraid of losing people.
Yeah.
And that's why they don't actually they're afraid to wake up. They're afraid of what the consequences are going to happen.
That's right. And in the process, they lose themselves or their potential self. You know, and instead of stepping up and being the best version of themselves, again, guided, as I mentioned, by this inner GPS way of thinking, what serves me best? What will I not regret? You can't guarantee the result on the outside world because we don't know the future. We can't totally control the future. We get glimpses of it, which we call precognition or premonitions. But I think the nature of reality, as I've understood and explained in my book, is that there's a certain inherent, intrinsic randomness to it all, even though there's a lot of design, yes, but there's also certain randomness. Just like we have a dream, we don't know in advance usually what we're going to dream, how many dreams, the quality of it, and so on. You know, unless you're skillful with the technique I teach in my book too, lucid dreaming. And so, if you know how to work with dreams intentionally, that's different. But in spontaneous dreams, you don't know what you're going to dream. You don't know how it's going to, you know, end up, so to speak. And that's sort of like the future for us too. Like we're experiencing things, but we don't know how it ultimately will manifest. Go ahead.
It gets to the point where we could teach this stuff to kids because I had intense dreams when I was a kid that were so terrifying. The lucid dreaming and back then, you know, in the 70s, you know, people would say, maybe you're possessed. You know, they would say stuff like that as a kid. Yeah. And I was like, really? Oh my God, something's wrong with me, you know? But I mean, if we could really have them not be so fearful and have a little bit more education. I mean, we never talk to kids about really, you know, have a good dream or a bad dream, but there's no connection as why they're there or that's important.
And also, you know, I was sharing in terms of your earlier question, you know, my origins, how I came to all of this. And I said one of them was my curiosity, and also becoming more and more fascinated by the realms of the imagination. But when we go through our education, even starting in you know, elementary, primary education, we're usually discouraged from what the teachers would might call daydreaming. And I certainly, a number of times, was called out, you know, stop daydreaming. And yet, it's imagination. It's a source of everything. And we're not taught to work with it.
And you're somebody that had a lot of education.
Yes, I have 3 degrees.
Yeah. And that's, you know, you have a lot of focus to do that.
Well, the other part of the awareness, again, is the discipline. You know, it definitely takes discipline. I'm 77 now, but I still try and do exercise every single day for an hour.
You know, so. I did see your age on something else, and I was, you know, that's another thing that I think people don't realize is I feel when you are living a little bit more authentically and you're connected to mm-hmm. your spirit, and you actually de-age. I feel like I look younger now than I did, you know, 15 years ago. Mm-hmm. I see older pictures of me when I was very more unconscious. I had suicidal thoughts. Mm-hmm. I was very lost. I was in fear to lose my job. I was in fear to lose friends. Mm-hmm. And I didn't know what my life purpose was. So I was just doing 9-to-5 jobs and coming home on the weekend and just really feeling sad. I see older, I actually encourage sometimes people to go back and look at images of themselves. Even standing next to other people, mm-hmm. because I don't know if everybody's like this, but I think I process things physically mm-hmm. and I can tell when I'm standing next to somebody, if they loved me or if there was like love there or mm-hmm. that it was a connection that was healthy mm-hmm. versus something, I could literally see it in pictures mm-hmm. and, without the filters, of course, but, you know, where I might look really ill next to somebody I had been dating that was very toxic for me. And when you have that realization that all these things are little signs that you don't have to ignore them. You could just look at them and go, oh, wow, that person I'm laying next to every night is affecting my energy field.
Yeah. But unfortunately, you know, in the world we live in right now, which is so materially and technologically focused, and so many people's attention is absorbed either directly or even just thinking about it when they're not directly doing it, oh, social media. They're not, their attention is not in the here and now, mm-hmm. and they're not aware and even able, because they don't have the experience, to be able to choose to shift to a deeper level of consciousness, still being so-called in the conventional world, but having access now to a wider bandwidth. You know, one level would be, let's say, creative thinking and creative problem solving, being able to do, but there's much more to it. How are back to the, let's say, the programming we're exposed to, more and more people are looking again for their way of connecting, for their work, for their social life, for health, even as I'm working on Zoom too for myself right now with the healthcare system, through these other so-called virtual means, as opposed to direct in-person contact. And even these days, people are getting so addicted to it, as you may know, at social gatherings. People often, even though they're together, maybe at the same table having a meal together, but their phones are up.
Yeah.
And you see people walking, you know, sometimes in the city, in the town, again, holding the phone, you know, instead of eyes open, maybe seeing someone that's an old acquaintance, or just nodding their head to someone new as a courtesy, mm-hmm. or smiling at a young baby, looking at them. So we're getting more and more unbalanced that way. And I think that too is making us more vulnerable to be stirred up with, again, fear and greed, which are our two primary driving emotions.
Yes. Okay, so I want to pack a few things. problem solving and conflict too. Conflict resolution skills. You know, we're going to have some conflict, but it's gone really disrespectful, especially vulnerable people. That most vulnerable people, I'm leaning back into the suicidal ideation just because that's my background mm-hmm. and stuff.
Yeah.
But, you know, they're trying to come out of a hole and they're vulnerable, but they're also trying to find their voice, you know? And so, for example, you just post one thing on one line online, right? And say mm-hmm. something, and you might not have worded it the best way, whatever. And I don't know how a community can feel like they can just pile onto that one person because they don't like that one line or that thing. You don't know the damage you're doing. That person might have just gotten out of bed for that day. Or, you know, we have to recognize that we're hurting each other's and each other's children. And if you want to, if you have family, which most of us have some sort of family, maybe if you don't want to think about yourself because you feel like you're a warrior, but think about, like, it's all going to just pile out. Yeah. I mean, this is what we really need to have these hard conversations of, because we are going to see people that are going to commit more suicide or that are so depressed that the ideation is slowly killing them.
Yeah. And unfortunately, as you may know, the suicide rate, especially among the young, is increasing. And as, you know, things get more challenging, even like it seemed like global climate change, the economic disruptions, it's more likely, sadly, we'll see more of that. And my heart goes out particularly to the younger people who have so not made this world that they now have to live in and largely suffer and increasingly suffer in their future. Again, why, as I say, I wrote my book as a wake-up call. It does not have to be this way.
No, there could be choices. You know, you can either look at something and choose to live in fear or live in love. And that's sort of what I do. I make it really simple.
Yeah.
And I get overwhelmed. And so I'm like, nope. That's fearful. I'm going to be scared. I got to go to love today. And it literally is, I'm making like constant choices all day long.
And that's excellent. And to you know, frame it in my medical terms for a moment. when we're in fear, there's a part of our brain called the amygdala, which is actually a primitive part of the brain in terms of lower animals have it as well. And it's the stress center. It's the threat detector. And when it senses some threat to the physical being or our ego, it goes on fire, so to speak, from 0 to 100 in just, you know, milliseconds almost. And we feel, again, this intense either fear or anger. Now, neurophysiologically, in terms of what the brain, you know, functions, so this is now activated, the amygdala. But when we do fMRI scanning of the brain, which shows us changes of blood flow with different types of thinking and emotional experiences, when the amygdala is activated because of fear or anger, the blood literally drains away from the prefrontal cortex, which is the thinking portion of the human brain. Mm-hmm. In computer terms, it goes offline, and we literally cannot think properly. So it's so important to get ahead of emotions before they do become overwhelming and totally control us.
You hear a lot of people talking about how we have that instinct, you know, if, you know, a tiger is coming for us, but
you don't fight or flight reaction.
We don't hear a lot of people talking though, that someone screaming at you and pushing you in a corner can get that same response. Right. And as you're saying this, like I'm starting to see, I understand now, like, cause what happens is like you said, you go offline cause you start to shut down.
Yeah.
As a protective mode, right?
Yeah.
And then there's a physiologic, like you said, the blood flow, right? And that causes probably inflammation in our body and all kinds of
cortisol goes up. Yeah. Yeah. And another thing, coming back to what we have to relearn, maybe, you know, the ancient teaching, which is not only in the Bible, but the Golden Rule, it's in other religions too, even though it may not be appreciated, but it is. The notion, you know, that, so to speak, we're not in this alone. We're all connected. So what you put out comes back to you. So treat others as you would have them treat you. Now, if we only did that one, you know, commandment, so to speak, or guideline in life for almost everything, it'd be transformational. We also know when people choose to volunteer to do things to help others or causes, which we call altruism, they not only feel better generally, as opposed to people who are depressed or stressed out, but they're also part of the solution. I mean, they're helping someone in some level of need. And we also know, again, going back to the medical side of it, physiologically, there are stress levels. We can measure it with sensors like, you know, blood pressure and heart rate and so on, go down. So they're helping someone else. They feel better emotionally and their body is less inflamed.
Yeah.
And even though they may feel powerless because of their own circumstances, for their own problems, their own challenges, if they still realize, despite that, that they can't, you know, solve everything for themselves, but there's somebody else in need and choose to try to help somewhat, it not only helps that person, helps their mood, but it also gets the prefrontal cortex back online.
Yeah.
And now they're also more resourced and able to take care of themselves. Now, that's the opposite of what people would think, you know, that if you're feeling overwhelmed, taxed out, how can you possibly feel better extending yourself to help someone else? But it does. Why? Because all of me, we're all connected.
Yeah. Yeah. Do you think that people realize how much damage they're doing to another person just by trying to prove a point?
No.
I think that.
No, they cut off, you know, they're cutting off their whole sense of empathy, of connection that way. That's why, like in war or riots and so on, people can do the most dehumanizing, degrading things we can possibly imagine in the worst horror movies. Because they have no empathy.
And the reality is you're not going to really change someone's point of view by harassing them or bullying them or yelling at them online. I mean, so it really is kind of like it's in a way pointless because that person has their view. And if whatever it is, so now you're putting out just this horrendous energy.
So another thing,
it's not helping anybody.
Well, people think at times, when this is, you know, happening, that is someone helping themselves because they have a strong feeling, let's say, of anger for whatever reason. And usually it's not a logical reason. And because of anger, they express it by, you know, online harassment or unfortunately even in a physical reality, as we know. But the issue there is on a, you know, if you look at it on a different level, they're doing something, again, controlled by their feelings of emotion because they're angry. They're getting it out. And subjectively, while they're doing it, they feel somewhat better, all right, because they vent it. Mm-hmm. And when we are, by contrast, in fear, anxious, we're more contracted. We feel weaker. Mm-hmm. But when we're in a state of anger, we feel stronger. Now, part of it's illusion, but unfortunately, we feel stronger. Mm-hmm. So there's like a temptation sometimes emotionally when we're, you know, fearful and overwhelmed by all the craziness in life that we have to suffer through, to feel strength and anger. And especially when we band together in conspiracy thinking or literally riot mobs, people feel stronger, but they're also more disconnected from what is the greater reality and the consequences that can ensue from it.
Yeah. And they're usually not coming up with solutions to the problem. They're just shouting the problem.
Not at all.
And so a lot of people, for me, if they want, I'm open to discussion. I always tell them I'm open to kind discussions. Mm-hmm. I will read whatever you send me. Mm-hmm. But if you're going to complain about something, please send me at least one solution. I haven't gotten one yet so far. So, but that's just because then they have to think of another way. Like, well, yeah. So what's the solution? If you have all this context.
Yeah.
Can you just come up with at least, what do you recommend? What do you recommend? You're such an expert.
And ideally, you know, if we know we have disputes and conflicts with people, and I'm not saying this is always easy for us or the other people we're having some conflict with because emotions are roused up. But if we can seek to dialogue, to communicate, and seek a win-win solution. So it doesn't mean one of us wins, one of us loses. Mm-hmm. What would be reasonably okay, given our differences, for both of us to live with?
Yes.
To think more that way, to seek it.
Well, that's where I'm a little worried about that the newer generation, because I don't think they're taught conflict resolution skills in a healthy way.
They're not even taught social skills anymore.
Yeah.
Because often they're not raised as like a generation or two by their parents, as they would have been. They have less interaction with their peers in real life as opposed to, again, on social media. Mm-hmm. The reality is also the news is less reliable than it used to be when we were kids and you didn't, you know, question the news. You may have known in, you know, old Russia, there was, you know, propaganda or censorship. But here in the West, in North America, in the U.S. particularly, people didn't question generally the accuracy of the news. Most of them tuned into the same three networks, had their favorite broadcasters. Mm-hmm. But now it's so different. There's not that common frame of reference at all.
No. And again, I really want to go back to the children I feel like are going to be bullied and potentially might kill themselves. We've heard those stories. We should only hear that happening once and realize that we have to be kind online, especially, I don't know. I feel like if someone's at least 21 or under or something, maybe there should be an extra level of protection. There could be anything that we just need to come together and, protect, especially people that don't have conflict skills yet. And I don't know, that's kind of where I've been fighting.
Maybe ideally, we'd have like ground rules for like social media. One rule might be never without exception any expressions of anger. Mm. Never.
Yes.
If you have facts that you think are not known or understood or logically connected, you can, present that type of information.
With a citation.
Not express anger against anyone. Sorry, what was that?
With a citation. You have to, you have to reference it like in your writing. Yeah. So, amazing. So, in the consciousness that you're talking about, so I guess we're talking about, there's this, you can kind of put everything into light or dark consciousness, or everything is just dark. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And to the dark, so there is like a dark consciousness as well. And that can kind of, do you think that's in a form of energy that surrounds the person in their energy field type thing?
Well, I think the dark, is about like an ego entrapment.
Mm.
That to me is the source and what sustains it. Like the ego is almost like a filter against the fuller perception of reality.
Yeah.
In many ways, that's what it is. And most of us don't know it. I mean, it's like subconscious. We assume we see things as they are, and we still do not.
I think you said it in your book, it was like the waves in the ocean.
Yeah. I think, on one level, obviously, we're separate beings. You're you, I'm me, you're there, I'm here, so to speak. We have a different appearance, different sounds of voice and all that. So on one level, us and everyone else is different on this. I call this the consensual level of reality. And to me, this is a level of reality, but it's only one level. So like the waves of an ocean, if you took a fixed photograph of the ocean, you could see individual waves. You could point them out perhaps and say, well, this is a bigger wave. This is a wider wave. This is just a baby wave. And if it's a video or if you're looking in real time, you see those waves change. Some that were small become larger. Larger ones eventually disappear. So again, although they seem separate at the very tips, the reality is they're all coming out of the same base, the ocean itself. Mm-hmm. So it seems like they're disconnected on the surface, and that's how we see life often, but ultimately they're all connected.
I heard something, I'm just going to mention this because I heard this is kind of crazy. Mm-hmm. You talk about water and ocean. I heard that all of the water, there's no new water that, when we have weather and rain, mm-hmm. and we're drinking water, mm-hmm. it's actually all the same. It's just recycled back.
Yeah. And in a sense, you could say the same thing, with the air we breathe.
I know.
All the air we're breathing has been exhaled by other people. And,
that's fascinating.
Some of the vegetation.
They were saying all the way, from when the dinosaurs are here, I'm like, the same water? But then I have this like conscious, like when I see water coming out of a faucet, mm-hmm. or I have like a more of a consciousness about how it's processing through me and how, and that's consciousness because it's just having some awareness of.
Yeah. But we need to have, a much deeper consciousness broadly coming out to water. Yeah. I was just reading a medical report earlier today that there's no place on earth which is free of microplastics. And they're now finding increasing medical evidence that unfortunately does correlate with our susceptibility to various physical diseases. I repeat, there's nowhere on the planet anymore free of microplastics. We're still producing them and we're still disposing of them. We keep making it worse. That's just one problem.
Yeah, everywhere.
Again, because of lack of broader awareness.
Yeah.
What are the consequences of our, preferences and actions? We don't think it through. I like the indigenous teaching, going back to something called the Law of Seven Generations. And if they wanted, as a tribe, to make some major decision, to potentially go to war with a neighboring tribe, to form an alliance with a neighboring tribe, to move their encampment grounds, to change their hunting patterns, they would try to think the implications, the consequences of these moves, 7 generations into the future. How does it affect the children of my children and their children and so on? We do the opposite. We do really short-term thinking, and largely, again, it's mostly dominated by immediate fear or our insatiable greed. We don't think it through.
No.
We're not. And we're paying the price. And the world is, sadly, too.
Yeah. Well, we got to be more conscious, and that's what we're here to do. Hey, I have a couple. I wanted to touch base before we end on a meditation that you're going to run mm-hmm. for us. But I just thought this was really interesting about, could you explain, you know, a lot of people are doing like taking mushrooms or psilocybin mm-hmm. to kind of transcend mm-hmm. their consciousness. What yeah. are your thoughts on that? And what happens to your body while people are under those kind of influences? And
I'm laughing because I can go on so much.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
These questions so deep. A number of things. First of all, we're now at a stage, both medically and politically, where the psychedelic chemicals, like psilocybin, which comes from mushrooms, is being more seriously both accepted and respected. It's one of the most exciting areas right now, honestly, in psychiatry. If used properly, and this is the big if, sometimes it can be curative in one single session, even people who have had severe PTSD. So it can be really helpful. On the other hand, normal people can go crazy, insane from those drugs too when they're using things they don't understand and in improper settings. So
yes.
it's to be used with caution, but it can be, you know, very valuable. What is it doing, back to your other question, to the brain? Interesting and strangely enough, when we look at the brain activity by various ways, either electrically or getting an fMRI, which shows us which parts of the brain are more active, when people are under the influence of the psychedelics like psilocybin, LSD, the brain actually goes quiet, stops working as much. And it seems to us the brain, again, is more like a filter, a selective filter. Mm. It's not receiving the consciousness of all awareness, all potential reality, just some of it. These drugs reduce the filtering ability of the brain, so more comes through. Just like if you're wearing dark sunglasses, everything looks somewhat dark. You take them off, you know, it's brighter. So it's sort of doing that. But the interesting thing, again, in terms of your question about the brain actually gets out of the way. In fact, the most developed part of the brain, like the prefrontal cortex, like the highest part for our thinking abilities, we understand how the brain works, it goes offline, it goes quiet.
So you can maybe transcend and see things that you couldn't see before because your mind has gone quiet. I'm not good on any of this. I don't do any of it just because I've trained through meditation mm-hmm. to kind of get there on my own.
Mm-hmm. Which always is the better way.
Which is healthier for me because I'm way too sensitive. And
but it is the better way, Gina, for most people.
In
the longer term, it's safer and there's more lasting, you know, benefit. But back to your question, the way it was used therapeutically for some people with certain conditions can be a game changer for them.
Yeah, because
but dangerous, I say, to play with.
Yeah, definitely see your doctor if you're going to do that. Because I'm also seeing it's very people doing it really recreationally.
I know
a lot, yeah. And at parties, at, you know, not where you're in a ritual situation. You know, you'll just walk in and it'll be right there. You know, ketamine and everything, and I get like.
I know. Back, you know, to my point, like people are not thinking things through.
Yeah, it's true. Be smart about it. Well, you've got a lot of meditations in your book again here, Dream It and To Do It, and The Science and the Magic. So you're going to walk us through just like a 3 to 5 minute meditation, and I'm going to let you take it away so we can have this. People can watch it over and over again. It will be also separated into the video. So you just want to watch the meditation part on in the morning or at night. And we can feel your great energy taking us out.
So I'll give you a bonus. I will give you what you asked for and more. All right. So the first technique that I would speak about that I think is really helpful in any situation when we're feeling overwhelmed or confused or weak, and I repeat, in any situation, and that is to go more internally, starting with focusing on your breath. So that's an internal thing as opposed to what's going on in the external world or the things you might be, you know, imagining, conjecturing that what could be going on or could happen eventually. So you're coming into the present by tuning in to the sensation of your breathing and then allowing your breathing to deepen from the belly level, the abdominal level. And then allow your breathing to become a little slower. And as you relax, it becomes easier to have slower breathing, but also the slower breathing helps it become more relaxed. And then extend the period of the exhalation when you're breathing out to be approximately twice as long as the time for your in-breath, your inhalation. So for example, if on inhaling, you, let's say we're having in your mind a count of three, as in one, two, three, on the out-breath, when you're exhaling, when you're breathing out, you would double that. One, two, three, four, five, six. As you get used to this, then try to allow yourself to have a bit of a pause between you when you have your full in-breath, your full inspiration, before you start the exhalation. And then after you've breathed out, after you've exhaled, try to have a little longer period of not breathing before you next inhale. In these intervals between breaths is your ability, when you become aware of it, to access almost a portal, a connection to your deeper self, to the deeper source, for balancing yourself emotionally, for helping you feel more resourceful in terms of better creative ideas and greater sense of connection, stability, satisfaction in all respects. And it's also something that can always be available to you as long as you remember this. It just takes a few moments. The other technique I would also just share while we're talking about this, which could be related or not, is what I call shower meditation. Many people say they don't have time to meditate, or it's just too difficult for them, or too expensive, whatever, to be in a meditation class or buy some device that may help them with meditation. In shower meditation, you need nothing extra. You don't need extra time. You don't need anything changed physically. What you do in shower meditation is train your mind, discipline your mind, to exclusively to only focus on sensations of the shower experience. So the spray of the water, the temperature in different parts of your body as you're moving around, the aroma, the texture of shampoos, of conditioners, of soaps you might be using. And you're guided by concept, if you like, or guideline, no thinking out of the shower. It's the opposite of we want to be creative, think out of the box. So you're trying to turn off the chattering mind, not just by willpower, but by, in a sense, substituting something else. Or am I going to focus on one thing fully at a time? So by choosing to subtly focus just on sensation in a safe and pleasant environment of the shower, you quiet your mind, you remove some of the chatter, the filtering, you're calmer, you're more resilient, you're sharper thinking going forward. And these are things you could do every time you have a shower.
Beautiful. Thank you. Thank you, Howard Eisenberg. Decoding Reality 2.0, Dream It to Do It. Thank you for coming on. And, you know, if we triggered anything in you today, look, we're not judging you. We are all in the same thing together. We just are wanting to have higher level conversations to support everyone around us. So please, you know, join us and, you know, send us notes or, you know, comment or whatever you feel is right. We'd love to hear from you. And we just really wish you well. We're just putting as much energy out there as possible to, you know, do what we can. And I know that you are too. So we want to thank you for that. And, you know, many blessings, everybody. This has been the Liberated Healer Podcast. Thank you for tuning in. Until next time. Thank you.
If you enjoyed this episode, you can find us online at theliberatedhealer.com, on Instagram at Liberated Healer Podcast, or on Facebook at The Liberated Healer. Give us a follow, subscribe, send us a message if you so feel, and thank you for your support. Podcast.